Good evening, lovelies. Welcome to another episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. My creative tonight is director Matt Yoka. His documentary, Whirly Bird, shines a light on news reporters Zoe Ter and Marika Gerard and their coverage of Los Angeles from the air during the 80s and 90s. Whirly Bird can be seen in theaters in Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, and Columbus. It's also available on demand through Amazon Prime and Apple TV. This episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives is brought to you by Jonathan Rackman's book, The Garlic Peanut Story. This book is a memoir in the form of letters sent to his niece and nephew after the passing of his beloved sister, Wei Wei. It's a story about devotion, loyalty, and the unbreakable bond that a brother and sister have, no matter the distance, no matter the time it remains. You can get more information about this book at thegarlicpeanutstory.com. If you order from the website directly, 100% of the proceeds go to children's charities around the world. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite beverage, cuddle up with your host Pup, and enjoy the show. So we are here tonight with Matt Yoka. He is the director of the Whirly Bird documentary, focusing on the partnership of Marika and Zoe. Back in the 90s, a lot of crazy stuff happened in LA, and this couple, they got all the great shots from their helicopter, right, Matt?
They got every, if it was in Los Angeles from basically 82 to 98, I would say, chances are that they were there covering it. So
I'm not exactly sure of the date, but we're talking the riots. We're talking after Rodney King.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking wildfires, mudslides, everything like that, huh?
Yeah. You know, they didn't really discern, I think, between highbrow and lowbrow news. I think anything that was happening in Los Angeles that was of interest, whether it was a celebrity wedding or social upheaval, they were going to go cover it. And they were relentless. And so they, name the event and they likely were there.
Right. And just like 24 hour, I'm imagining dusk to dawn and overnights and just always at spur of the moment, you get a phone call or you know, back in the day, your beeper goes off. Right.
Marika and Zoe used to, they told me that they would sleep with the police scanner on. So in their bedrooms, they had a police scanner, and they would be in this sort of half asleep, half alert state, and would awake when they would hear a certain police call. I can't remember what what those codes were, but Zoe has them all memorized. You know, every police or fire code, she knows what it is. So that would get her out of bed, and they'd go run and get the story. So yeah, that's exactly what would happen. That could be let's just say that could be a tiresome lifestyle. So yeah.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, if you're a couple and you're kind of canoodling, the scanner goes off and it's like, oh, yeah, kind of like a parent that attunes themselves to the sound of their baby's cry, their baby cry.
Right.
So then that the scanner goes off and it's like, oh, we're up. Okay, let's go. We got to do this. We got to do that. So,
yeah. You know, and I think that they, Marika at least says that, you know, it was largely the work that kept them together. And in some ways, I think I allude in the film to their relationship and their intimacy was based in this work that they did. And whether that's sort of like getting off, like Marika in the film compares getting certain shots to an orgasm, or the actual kind of, in some ways, the helicopter becomes a little bit of a metaphor for me as this singular entity that they lived, that they occupied together. So they were like one in the same, I think, a sort of mind meld that was in this exoskeleton called a helicopter.
Wow. Oh, and the helicopter is almost like a third member of the relationship.
They, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Katie, the daughter. She said that the helicopter was another member of the family.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Now, is the helicopter's name Whirly Bird?
No, Whirly Bird is sort of an old term for helicopters. It was used back in like the Korean War and Vietnam. And I felt that it was a fitting term mm-hmm. for the film because I think it kind of encapsulates that word whirl, just kind of felt so much like what their life was for so many years.
Right. You know, that lifestyle, it picks them up and it spins you around. Sometimes you don't exactly even know which way you're going because just so tumultuous and it's just so up in the air. No pun intended. But yeah, so that's
plenty awesome. Of puns, plenty of puns in the world of helicopter documentary filmmaking, I've found.
Right. Well, how did you learn about this project? How did this idea come to you? How did you get involved?
Well, I'm from Los Angeles and I was eager to kind of explore the city. And so that was sort of where I started. And I was looking at stories that were taking place in the 90s in particular. I don't know if you're familiar with films like Heat and Point Break, but I always kind of found those films to be interesting because they both seem like parodies of Los Angeles, but they really do kind of feel like LA at the same time. And so right. I think that I was drawn to exploring that world. And I do think with helicopter reporting, you could almost imagine as though that would be a Michael Mann or a Catherine Bigelow film, but it's not. It's a true story. So so that's kind of what brought me to them, and that's what brought me to helicopter reporting. That's what got me interested in the story in general. And then after just doing a little bit of research, you kind of come across Zoe Ter's career pretty quickly, and just what an extraordinary list of accomplishments she had doing that work. So yeah.
He was the cameraman and she was the reporter.
They actually met at a place that Marika was working, which is the Bruin Theater in Brentwood. She was working the ticket counter and he was working, Bob at the time was just hanging out in the neighborhood and spotted her and thought she was cute and invited her out on a date. And their first date, though, they describe as sort of doing night crawler, so to speak, reporting. They went out to a crime scene and filmed these murder scenes in downtown Los Angeles. So immediately in the beginning of their relationship, they started covering news. It was just this, I think in some ways it was this adventure that they were going on, but I think that Zoe in particular had a real calling for news. And at the time, she was just, I think, still a teenager, maybe just early 20s, and already kind of pursuing that career. So quickly became inextricable.
So they kind of just went out and did it on their own, not with a news channel behind them or anything.
To a certain extent, that's how they always did it. They partnered with news channels later, but they always essentially were independent news gatherers. The company that they formed, the Los Angeles News Service, was a, you know, I would you could compare it to the AP, the Associated Press, in that they were gathering stories and they were they're available for purchase to whatever news outlets wanted them. But in the later years, as the scale got bigger and bigger for them, they initially partnered with KCOP, a local news station they partnered with, and then eventually went over to KCBS, CBS's a local affiliate in Los Angeles. So
that's cool. It tickles me because it's like, hey, there's a dead body over there. Let's go. And then just, you know, kind of doing your own thing and being so proactive and jumping into your destiny or your future.
I think that they definitely had sort of a morbid curiosity from the early days. But I would also argue that so does many people who consume the news. So I wouldn't say that they necessarily are alone. I just think they may have been a little more proactive than others about seeking that out.
Well, definitely doing things that people thought about but didn't actually do or wanted to, but didn't have the cojones to go and actually do it themselves.
One way of putting it, yeah.
I mean, if you want something, you have to go for it, right?
And Zoe is unlike anybody I've ever met in that that mantra, yeah.
When did the helicopter come into it? I mean, that's pretty substantial purchase.
I believe Zoe first bought her first helicopter in, I'm blanking on the date. Was it 88? I have to double check, but I think it was late 80s when she bought their first helicopter. And, you know, they were making pretty good money, especially back then. Local news was a pretty profitable business. In Los Angeles, you have the big, that's the biggest local news outlet or market, I should say, in all of America. And so that was good business, and they were getting a lot of scoops. So what Zoe did was slowly put money away until she had, as she says, $50,000, and she went to Bell Helicopters, which is, in the way she describes it, it's almost as though she went to an auto dealership. She just went to Bell Helicopter, and a floor agent came up and said, "What would you like?" And Zoe said, "I'm interested in buying a helicopter. I got $50,000, and you know, here are my invoices that are coming in. The money I'm making." They said, "Okay, we'll front you the, you put that money down, and we'll open up some credit for you." And she walked off with a helicopter. So the funny thing, though, is she didn't even have a helicopter's license at that point. She bought a helicopter before she had a license. So a real go-getter.
Yeah, and that's not something you just go down to the DMV and grab.
It was one of those things that we had to cut out of the film because there wasn't enough time. But her training process was so interesting because she learned how to fly through the Los Angeles Fire Department, their helicopter, I guess you'd call it, I don't know, their fleet of helicopters. Whoever was managing that fleet was taught Zoe how to fly. And she has these incredible stories about the lessons they gave her. And I think she credits them for really becoming the incredible pilot that she is. And most people say that Zoe, albeit, well, can potentially freak you out when she's flying because she is so aggressive, but she's actually incredibly safe. And I think that's a testament to her training. So she tells us one story. I hadn't really thought about this until recently, but she told us one story about how she'd be flying with the LA Fire Department, and they would do something like say, "Hey, what's that out there?" And she would kind of look off, and then they would kill the engine. So the engine off in midair. And so she would have to do, I'm getting rusty with all my helicopter lingo. There was one day, engine off, rotation landing, I believe it is. So it's essentially using the momentum of the blades to land the helicopter rather with the engine off. So it's she did tons of those. And so she's a pro. So yeah. She became a very good pilot, and you can see that in the film throughout the
right. Well, she was just trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, become a good pilot. So I'm sorry. So you got interested in helicopter, that led you to Zoe. Mm-hmm. And so then you kind of were hearing all the stories, and then the idea for the documentary came about, or were they already planning it? Anything like that?
No, I was, when I read about Zoe, I thought to myself that this is the person that I've been looking for to make a documentary about. Wow. So I remember very vividly kind of feeling like I just got struck with this immediate clarity that this is the story that I want to tell. Even though I understood so little of the story, but I just kind of had this feeling. And so I sought her out, and we met up, and we were talking over the first lunch that we were talking. I said, "I think I have to make a documentary about you." And to her credit, she let me do that.
Oh, wow. And so when did this happen?
That was, I first met Zoe in November of 2013. So really kind of the beginning of 2014 is when I started the process. And from there, started doing research. We did preliminary interviews. I started looking at the archive. But it wasn't until we got funding that was until 2018. So there was about a 4-year period of me just developing and pitching it. And then once I got that, then I was able to, really kind of immerse myself in the filmmaking.
So I saw that this went to Sundance. What was that like?
It was a very surreal experience. This is the first film I've made. So it was and I'd never even really been to a film festival before. So it was a very kind of disorienting experience and exciting. And they really have a way of kind of celebrating films there that makes the work that you put into it feel like it's appreciated. Mm-hmm. So that's all thrilling and amazing. And it was great. I had my family there and friends. And so we were all enjoying it. And then there was kind of the whiplash experience that was COVID that came just about a month and a half after that. So we kind of hit pause on the release of the film last year. And so it was this like very high and low kind of journey. Hopefully the high is coming back now, but the, yeah, that was to be honest, it was a little bit of a difficult ride after Sundance. So, but I do feel fortunate that I had that opportunity to be there, especially, you know, knowing other filmmakers that weren't able to do live events over this last year. So very, mm-hmm. very lucky in that sense.
Right. So it's available on most major platforms like Prime, things like that?
Yeah, you're going to be able to stream it on August 6th on both Amazon and Apple. And if you happen to be in Los Angeles or Chicago or New York, a few other locations, you'll be able to see it in theaters, actually. So that's exciting for me. But I'm just happy that people are going to be able to see it one way or another. So I think
right, because it is very good and it's very well done. And it's just such a fascinating subject. I mean, I can barely remember, but seeing that stuff on the news and going back to what you were saying about the news outlets and the good pay. This was before the social media. This was before all these extra stations, pretty much, you know, in the early, or the late 80s, you only had your major news outlets. Yeah. You know, 20 minutes or your, or 60, well, not 20 minutes, 60 minutes.
Was it 2020? I think there's a whole host of those news TV, I guess you call them TV magazine shows, 60 mm-hmm. Minutes, Dateline. There's a whole bunch of them, Hard Copy, Inside mm-hmm. Edition, all those kinds of things that were going on. But yeah, the film is a time capsule. And as much as I really believe at the core, this is the story of a relationship, mm-hmm. it's also an opportunity to reflect on several things, one in which being news media and the evolution of news media. And so you are seeing this in a lot of ways. You're even seeing pre-cable news. So it's not even, you don't even have 24-hour. I mean, CNN is a baby at this time. You know, it's like a novelty idea. The majority of people are still getting their news from the major networks. And so yeah, I think it also is an interesting opportunity to kind of reflect on how things have changed and maybe how the work that Zoe and Marika did contributed to that change. So,
I mean, are you old enough to remember when TV programming shut off for the night? I think it was at like midnight.
Yeah, the salute.
Mm-hmm, the American flag would wave.
Yeah, I love that, actually. I wish we should bring that back. I feel like people would maybe be happier if all TV and media just signed. Yeah,
yeah. I total agreement. I feel like we have too much information. We have too much stimulation. Mm-hmm. What did I say the other day? I said something about a lot of times we are well-informed idiots because we're informed. We know a bunch of stuff, but it's not necessarily making us smarter or better people. It just means that we know a bunch of stuff about a bunch of stuff, not say a bad word. To go back to Zoe and Marika, what they were doing, so raw, so real, mm-hmm. so true. No fluffing it like you see in certain news media outlets. Mm-hmm. We're not going to go there. But it wasn't fluffed. It was just the facts. It was, this happened. This is what we know about it. Not, I think that it's because of this or this, you know, da, 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 da. And that is so like refreshing. Plus, I busted out laughing because there's a part really close to the beginning, I think it is, when it first starts talking about them as reporters. Or, you know, reporting. And he's like, don't step on the cord or something. And she's like, I'm not stepping on the cord. Are you stepping on the cord?
Yeah.
And I was like, isn't that a couple right there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because I kind of like to say that their story is very extraordinary. But a lot of, I think, when you strip away kind of the elements like helicopters and camera, you know, reporting and O.J. Simpson chasing, all those kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is really, I think there's a lot that resonates for people about their relationship and what it means to be in a relationship and try to raise a family, both the good and the bad. And I think like that, what I hope is kind of the effect of watching the film is you're taken on this adventure, but you're given a chance to reflect on stuff that you might relate to in one way or another. Whether it's, you know, your relationship with the news or relationships that you have with people in your life, you know, these are all kinds of things that I think that the film allows you to explore.
Right. And it's something when you're watching, especially real events, to see a person or a couple or a group or whatever, and just think they're doing this phenomenal thing. They're doing this glamorous thing or this awe-inspiring, dangerous, wow. And then you see something that brings it back home to you, like, oh, okay. Yeah. They're not as these gods or demigods. They're people. So it makes it relatable. I feel like it invests you more in their story.
Yeah. I wanted the film, and I think, you know, the people I worked with on the film, editors and producers, we really were committed to telling the story with nuance and without judgment, but we also didn't want to look away from, you know, the harder, you know, the troubles that they faced in their relationship, and also the problematic nature of some of the work that they did, even if it necessarily wasn't always intentionally problematic, it just, you know, kind of evolved into this thing. So I'm happy to hear that some of that resonated with you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you have to think, with the stories they covered, you said, you know, murders and things like that, as hard as you try, some of it has to come home with you. Then you're married or you're a couple and you're both feeling some sort of way from the thing you just experienced, but trying to take it out on each other because you understand that, you know, so it's
Trump. Yeah.
Yeah. The tricky balance, shutting it off.
Yeah. I was thinking about that a lot for reporters in general, how difficult it must be to cover such intense moments and then to kind of try to return to some semblance of normalcy. And I think often carrying around a lot of trauma that is going unchecked. And I think that, yeah, in some ways in the work that I've done in the past, I kind of can relate to that, although I don't think I ever quite reached anywhere near the scale and consistency of which Zoe and Marika were covering stories, but yeah.
Well, what is your background? I'm sorry, we didn't get into that. We didn't talk about you first. I apologize.
Well, that's all right. Their story is more interesting than mine, so that's fine.
Were you born and raised in LA, or are you a transplant?
I was born and raised in Los Angeles, yeah. I left when I went to college, and after college, I started working for Vice Media. I was doing a lot of culture reporting initially, or culture storytelling, I might call it, and then sort of dipped into a little bit more of the newsier side of things, which is really kind of how the Vice evolved. So I worked with Vice on and off for about 10 years, learned a lot about storytelling, videography, editing, just events in the world. I mean, it was a big learning process for me in so many different ways being at Vice. But I think all the while I was very interested in telling feature length stories. And so I was developing this film while doing various projects for Vice. So that was kind of a balance that I was trying to strike. That was at times a lot.
Was Vice the channel with the true crime stories and cops and things like that?
Vice never played cops. Vice was initially a magazine was out of Toronto. It was kind of a counterculture magazine, but they would Within it had a very irreverent tone to it, but within it was some interesting reporting, and that kind of evolved into these video segments that they started producing and publishing online on their website, and that gained a lot of traction in the around 2009, 2010, and the company just kind of ballooned. And so they eventually had a show on HBO. And then from there, they went to, they developed their own network. And so they have a TV network to this day, Vice TV. And it's all, I think still is all nonfiction based, but there's a lot of different iterations of that, different topics that they explore. They go all over the world. I'm proud to have worked with them as they grew into this huge company, and they taught me a lot along the way.
Yeah, it's always nice to see something grow that you get, like, proud that you were a part of it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like Whirlybird, I mean, this is gonna be a great film for people to see in a theater. So I'm excited that you've got at least a limited run right now. Major cities, it sounds like. I'd like to see it in maybe an Orlando theater so I can go and see it on the big screen. I've seen it, but to see it on the big screen, I mean, that's going to be fantastic.
I do really think that it works. I think every filmmaker likes to believe their film plays well on a big screen, but I really think this one does, because the footage is just so spectacular over the years of them flying over Los Angeles and just on the streets of LA. It's so visceral and sweeping, and I'm also really proud of the sound design work that we did with it. So I think when you have a really good theater with great sound design, it really does kind of pick you up and take you for a ride. So I would love for it to play in Orlando. I don't know if we're going to pull it off, but maybe you can start some sort of petition and get a bunch of people going to the.
Absolutely. Excuse me. I have to start making some phone calls, send some emails.
That you think it would work though. Yeah.
Even just for the bird's eye view when they're flying over.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I think so too. It was really a treat to, you know, some of the things that you don't get to include in the film, just because there's only so much time, but there's just so much footage of them flying over the city for hours. And so, you know, some of it's just simply street after street or mountain ranges or desert, beaches, mm-hmm. and it just kind of goes on and on. And there's something sort of hypnotic. It's almost like, the interesting thing is that their work amounted to this kind of hyper stimulating news experience. But when you look at a lot of the raw tape, it's almost like slow TV. You know, it's just this kind of just these endless sequences of flying over Los Angeles. So, anyway, just thinking back to being in the edit.
Yeah. I mean, you're like, you want to use as much of it as you can, but then you're like, we've been on this road for a few minutes. Maybe we should cut this part. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think ultimately it, the long, sort of hypnotic shots doesn't really speak as much to what I felt was their experience, which was, I think, a much more fast pace. So I prioritized a lot of editing, a lot of fast edits, and a lot of, frenetic camera work. So you kind of get into that zone of that kind of go
right.
It's definitely quick, so that's one way of describing it for sure.
Well, sometimes when you're watching something like this, you want your viewer to be jolted a little bit.
Yes,
because absolutely. You want to relax and watching, it's like, oh, okay, I'm paying more attention now because, you know, you got my attention riveted.
Yeah I really I, it's not something that I want to do just for the sake of doing that to the audience, but I think in effort to try to immerse the audience in their in the lives of Zoe and Marika, I felt that was the way that the film should function. It is fun to kind of be, you know, the opening sequence of the film, I think, is maybe the best example of just that at its core, which is you're flying over the city. That's the opening shot. And almost when you start to zone out, the camera whips up and you realize that you're, you know, it whips up to reveal the undercarriage of the helicopter. And so, you know, it's that kind of like, here we go kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that was the goal.
It definitely grabbed your attention.
Buckle up. Yeah.
Oh. So you said, obviously a showing in LA, showing in New York City, August 6th, you said, right?
August 6th, yeah.
Chicago,
New York, Los Angeles. Most of the screenings are in LA. So yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of, I guess we'll kind of see where it goes from there. But I felt like it was important for, of course, I think that everybody deserves a chance to see it on a big screen. But I think Angelino's in particular, it was a priority for me to try to give that opportunity and hopefully create a little bit of a community experience, because I think we've been so disconnected now for more than a year that it'd be nice mm-hmm. I love the idea that there's something that is reason to bring a handful of people together. So if my movie helps be one of those things, then I think that's great.
Well, it's definitely part of their history. So absolutely, you would want them to be able to see it in the city that all of these things happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. I know, well, California in general, but Los Angeles, you guys have been just quarantined. You've been locked down. You haven't done much, right?
We get pretty serious out here. Yeah. Yeah. It's been a little bit of a cabin fever like experience, but we did get a month out. We did get the sunshine for about a month, but now we're mostly trying to, it seems like people are still gathering indoors. It's just trying to be a little bit more conscious about mask wearing, I guess, seems to be it. I don't know. I'm just trying to do what I'm told here.
Right. Well, I mean, the sooner everybody does what they're told, the sooner maybe the things will lighten up a little bit. But heard me say I'm in Florida, and I know you've seen Florida on the news not being able to behave. So I'm behaving. Other people are not so much. But
I do think Florida is a pretty wild and interesting place, though. So I do like going out there when I can.
Yeah. Well, when we get the Orlando showing, you'll have to come.
I'll be there.
You're right. And it's so funny because a lot of people I've talked to that are from LA that are working in LA, they've been talking about being in lockdown, but it's really prompted a lot of creativity. They're doing a lot of things that they wouldn't have necessarily done before they were, you know, forced to stay home. But I think another problem a lot of filmmakers are having is you have your project, you have your film and you love it. And a lot of the indie filmmakers are finding this too. There's so many movies that have been sat on for a year, big movies. So for a little indie filmmaker, they're kind of terrified theatrical release because, you know, Black Widow's coming, you know, or the new Top Gun, you know. So
that's why I feel like I got an ace up my sleeve here, because I got an action adventure of a movie too. So, you know, like, if you guys want explosions and high-speed pursuits and helicopters flying through the sky, it just so happens that my indie documentary provides that too. So Black Widow is not the only place to get that fix. I just think you have to get a little more substance with this film. No knocking on the Black Widow.
Isn't to show up? What are you doing? It's a true story. And it's that people that have lived in Los Angeles their entire lives, you know, of a certain age, will go, oh my God, I forgot about that. You said the O.J. Simpson chase, and I was like, oh, yeah, because I forgot. Mm-hmm. I didn't forget O.J. Simpson, but I forgot about the white Bronco, you know, and it's just, I think it's going to do very well in Los Angeles. I think people will flock.
I think that when making the film, I did want to prioritize making something that was complex and filled with, I think, depth and an opportunity to really get some substance from the filmmaking experience. But I also wanted it to be entertaining and riveting. And so I tried to make both of those experienced in one here. So, you know, and I hope that brings some people in that might not necessarily be looking for documentaries per se, or not looking to initially to explore some complex issues that I think the film has in it. So, we'll see who's drawn to it and what they get out of it.
Well, absolutely. They're going to come for the excitement of the helicopter or the footage, but then they're also going to get a lesson, so to speak, of racial inequality. They're going to see the justice system in action, or, you know, the police system in action. So they're going to learn, maybe reluctant, but they're going to learn as they're entertained. The perfect marriage, no pun intended again.
yeah, that was a big priority for me. So I hope that it reaches people in that way.
All right.
Yeah, whirlybirdfilm.com.
Whirlybirdfilm.com. All right, and that'll have the show times and the theaters that it's going to be available in after, from August 6th on.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, sounds fantastic. I look forward to seeing it on a big screen. I've been blessed enough to see it on a little tiny screen, and it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just a great job.
I really appreciate you taking the time to watch it and think on it. It's, it means a lot. So thank you so much.
If you would pass along my greetings to Zoe, Marika, and Katie.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll let the whole family know you said hi.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. You have a wonderful evening, and it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
You too, Jeffy.
Okay. All right. Have a good night.
You too. See ya.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Matt, and I really hope that you head to the theaters or to your local computer and watch Whirly Bird. It truly is a spectacular film. Please also go to thegarlicpeanutstory.com. Get Jonathan's book. I guarantee you will be so touched by it. It is such an amazing story. You feel as if you're truly there, and that you, thegarlicpeanutstory.com. 100% of the proceeds go to Children's Charity. charities around the world. Be sure to head over to beunique.org, visit my lovely partners over there, show them some love, show them some support. For me, you can find me on social media. I'm on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, all of those guys under Pup Duffy. You can also look for the show on Facebook, Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. As always, take care of each other, love each other, look out for each other, and I'll see you next time.